and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the anonymously authored op-ed in the New York Times by a senior Trump administration official, "I am part of the resistance inside the Trump administration," which has the president lashing out in a fury as a flurry of denials are issued from his senior White House staff in an ominous atmosphere of threatened purges. Dr. Michael Carpenter, the former foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and director for Russia on the National Security Council, who has an article at Foreign Affairs co-authored with Joe Biden, "How to Stand Up to the Kremlin, Defending Democracy Against the Enemies," joins us. We'll discuss the op-ed's charge that Trump fought against sanctioning Russia for the nerve agent attack in Britain and how the unnamed author describes the resistance inside the administration as not the work of the deep state, but, quote, the work of the steady state. We'll examine the possibility that the few adults left in the room could soon be purged by a paranoid president who could install Ivanka and Jared to run the show. And on top of what both the op-ed and Bob Woodward's book make clear, that our president himself is a danger to America's national security, we will explore the even grimmer possibility that Trump is a compromised tool of a malign foreign power. Then, with the November elections fast approaching, we will assess the likely political impact of the charges against their leader on the supine and craven House and Senate GOP enablers of Trump by a Republican official on the inside of Trump's administration who is sounding the alarm about a dangerous and dysfunctional presidency. David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and the former editor of Foreign Policy and author of The Great Questions of Tomorrow, joins us to discuss the anonymous author's invocation of John McCain at a time when there is an ugly partisan determination by GOP senators to seat Trump's choice for the Supreme Court. Then finally, we'll go to the UK to speak with Nico Hines, the London editor of the Daily Beast, who previously was a reporter for the Times of London and their Washington correspondent. He joins us to discuss his article at the Daily Beast, how Russian spies used a fake Nina Ricci perfume bottle to smuggle Novichok nerve agent into England, and what steps the unpopular British government can take to retaliate against Russia to deter further attacks. And joining us now is Dr. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control, who previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as director for Russia at the National Security Council. Prior to that, he was a career foreign service officer with the State Department, and he's now a senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has an article at Foreign Affairs co-authored with former Vice President Joe Biden, "How to Stand Up to the Kremlin, Defending Democracy Against Its Enemies." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carpenter.
Thank you.
And clearly this op-ed in the New York Times, anonymously written by somebody that's apparently a senior official in the Trump administration, has got the White House in a panic. But I'd like to sort of zero in on the passage about Russia, particularly now, for example, that the British have been able to identify the two GRU Russian military officers who planted the Novichok nerve agent in Salisbury that almost killed the former GRU spy and his daughter, but did kill, as collateral damage, a British citizen and gravely poisoned her partner. So that's the latest break in that. So, and still... the Russians deny it, but in this anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, the author says, "On Russia, for instance, the president was reluctant to expel so many of Mr. Putin's spies as punishment for the poisoning of a former Russian spy in Britain. He complained for weeks about senior staff members letting him get boxed into further confrontations with Russia, and he expressed frustration that the United States continued to impose sanctions on the country for its malign behavior. But his national security team knew better. Such actions had to be taken to hold Moscow accountable. This isn't the work of the so-called deep state. It's the work of the steady state." So let's start with the steady state. If Trump is now so freaked out that he's going to purge the place, are we going to end up with no adults in the room and the White House basically have Jared and Ivanka running the show?
Well, I think the president is right now in a position where he must not trust anyone in the White House or within his cabinet, which is, for someone like himself, who is very erratic, very unstable, very narcissistic, already prone to paranoia, this is only going to exacerbate the sort of personality flaws in our president, and is frankly going to lead to a very scary situation that we're now entering. We've been in this situation for some time, but I think things are heating up in a way that is simply unsustainable. And so I worry about the ability of the so-called adults in the room, people like Mattis and Pompeo, to rein him in. This op-ed mentions Russia sanctions, but then there's also Bob Woodward's book, which mentions the fact that the president apparently wanted to assassinate Bashar al-Assad, and the order was refused by Secretary of Defense Mattis. You know, we're finding ourselves now in this period where, you know, he might do something rash, and, you know, the question is, can the adults rein him in? Can they avoid his direct orders? Or will he try to go around them and implement his desires or his policy instincts in some other way? And could we find ourselves in a really dangerous national security situation as a result? That really worries me.
Well, you have to start with the nuclear codes. That's the worst case scenario. The fact is that there's no constitutional or bureaucratic impediment between the president and ordering nuclear strike. That happens to be a fact, does it not?
It is. The order should go through Secretary Mattis, but, you know, it's unclear to me if the president ordered, for example, a nuclear strike or a conventional strike against one of our adversaries, you know, how the Pentagon would respond. I mean, I suppose Secretary Mattis could resign and refuse to implement the order. And then, you know, we'd have to see whether that deterred Trump from going forward with it. But we're finding ourselves talking about a hypothetical situation, which is not unlikely, not entirely unlikely, and extremely scary. And, you know, I should add to that, Ian, you know, I think that especially as the Mueller investigation starts to tighten the noose around the president and his family members, the potential for a wag the dog scenario where he decides, not necessarily on launching nuclear weapons, but on some sort of military activity or adventure to detract attention from his troubles at home, becomes increasingly likely. And, you know, I don't mean to be a scaremonger, but I am worried about these things. And I think the public, you know, should be aware that, you know, unfortunately, these are things that we all have to contemplate these days.
But when you talk about the American public, of course, the public is divided, and there's something like 30% or more of the American people inside the sort of Fox News bubble that basically says everything in the mainstream press or the so-called fake news press is fake news, and everything that Trump tells you is the truth. How do you prick that bubble? Because so far, Trump's behavior has been pretty outrageous. Just the other day, he wants to fire his attorney general on the basis that the attorney general indicted what looks like a couple of crooked Republican congressmen, basically saying
That's right.
I mean, that's extraordinary. That is absolutely breathtaking. But then
it is a breathtaking usurpation of the rule of law to suggest that the Department of Justice should not have gone forward with indictments and convictions against two congressmen for corruption because they were Republicans. And it's just astounding. But yeah, we find ourselves now with a public that unfortunately is very divided. There is a certain percentage out there that, you know, I'm convinced that, you know, Trump could, as he himself said, walk into Fifth Avenue and commit murder and would still be with him. I mean, I don't know what it's going to take for some people to see that we have someone in the White House who is conning the American public and lying on a regular basis about very important matters, not just trivial things, having to do with his personal history or affairs or whatnot, but you know, things of consequence to the nation and our national security. And you know, I don't know how you prick that bubble. We've gotten, I mean, there's certain elements of the current situation that remind me of the 1930s in Italy with Mussolini in power, and some of the propaganda that he used to aggrandize power. And it's just a difficult situation. But I think, you know, I think if we get to a point where Robert Mueller is able to lay some convincing facts out there for the public to see, and if we have a Congress that is willing to hold hearings, potentially after the midterms, into some of those facts, then, you know, it's possible that that, you know, base sort of diminishes to the real core, whatever that may be, 30%, 25% of the electorate, and then it becomes a little bit less of an impediment to moving forward with more responsible policymaking. But right now, certainly the nation is divided, and Trump is using that to his advantage.
Well, it does seem, though, that you've got, in spite of the 30%, and they're holding firm, and frankly, I blame Rupert Murdoch more than the people that are inside that bubble, because he's the one that's creating the collective delusion. And I don't know what his motives are. Apparently he gets off the phone. He talks to Trump regularly and gets off the phone and says, what an idiot this guy is, yet he's propping him up. So that's something that's very puzzling. But some of these people really revere the military and support national security in its broadest sense. What I'm getting from this op-ed and from Woodward's book and from watching what's been going on and talking to people as much as you can find out what's going on the inside, is that you could make the case that our president, Donald Trump, is himself a danger to our national security. And then you have to add to that the really scary possibility that he may be under the thrall or even the control of a malign foreign power. So will that get through? I mean, that to me is a hard thing to people get their heads around, but I think increasingly it's becoming clear.
Yeah, well, I think the Woodward book and I think this op-ed are causing some stalwart supporters of President Trump's to have a little bit of cognitive dissonance and rethink their views about how he's governing. You know, I happen to know an individual who's actually a Trump supporter who I've known for many years, and we share similar views, for example, on Russia. You know, this individual is convinced that Trump has some sort of chaos strategy to negotiations, and that, you know, he's so unpredictable and rash and erratic in a very calculated way to achieve some sort of diplomatic goal. I find that to be nonsense, because he hasn't achieved any diplomatic successes at all, certainly not with Kim Jong-un, certainly not with Putin, and nowhere else. But I think when people like that, who sort of, I think, subscribe generally to a traditional Republican orientation, when they see an op-ed like this, which to me is clearly written by a political operative inside the White House, I think, you know, they have to question the sanity and the decision making abilities of our president, and hopefully this will convince at least some of those types of people, maybe not the base out there in the heartland, but at least some folks to rethink their support for this president, and especially their what has been a rather unconditional support, despite numerous evidence to support this view that that things are a little bit unhinged inside the West Wing, because it's not just Robert Woodward, it's not just this anonymous New York Times op-ed writer, but I mean, it's everything going back to what we heard from, you know, in the Scaramucci scandal with the resignation of Priebus, with Omarosa, all these other people who have come out. They're all documenting a set of facts that you know, they all sort of align and point to the same thing.
And the word unhinged has been used on a number of times by both Omarosa and in the Woodward book, attributed to the Chief of Staff, General Kelly. But in the op-ed, the anonymous White House staffer, senior staffer apparently, says, take foreign policy. In public and private, President Trump shows a preference for autocrats and dictators such as President Vladimir Putin of Russia and North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. Well, today, the Justice Department just indicted the hackers behind Sony and stole $81 million from a bank in Bangladesh. They were after $1 billion, but they made a one-letter spelling mistake and only got $81 million. That's what you're dealing with in North Korea, but Trump elevated...
Not to mention the WannaCry malware.
The WannaCry, exactly.
Which affected over 150 countries around the world.
Right, and shut down hospitals, for God's sake. I mean, this is the guy that gets feted by Trump in Singapore. And even, I think by now, Trump must know he's come up empty-handed. It's just it was so obvious from the beginning that he was...
Yeah, it's a charade.
It's charade.
I mean, he's come up empty-handed. He thinks that if he says enough times that he achieved a marvelous success in his meeting with Kim Jong-un and that the North Korean leader is going to live up to his vague promise of denuclearization, that at least some people will buy it. But he knows he's got nothing there, and he knows that the longer things get drawn out and the more evidence comes in that North Korea is marching right ahead with its nuclear program and its missile program, that eventually he's going to find that the emperor is wearing no clothes. But that's the case now on so many different issues. Certainly with Russia, the notion, you'll recall at the start of the administration, there was this notion that, no, there weren't any contacts with Russians. It's all made up. It's fake news. Now they're saying for a while they were saying there was no collusion. Now they're starting to say, well, but collusion isn't really a crime. I mean, they keep shifting the goalposts. But, I think on that, too, they'll find that at the end of the day, the emperor is naked, and there are extensive contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia, between people very close to Trump, like Michael Cohen and various Russian individuals, and that a lot of those individuals were agents of Russian intelligence. And so we'll have to see whether it was a criminal conspiracy. That's a high bar. But certainly things are, the facts are pointing in that direction.
Well, just to make your day, Dr. Carpenter, President Trump tweeted out today, Kim Jong-un of North Korea proclaims unwavering faith in President Trump. Thank you, Chairman Kim. We will get it done together.
Yeah, it's an amazing statement for the president, especially to use that term, unwavering faith, when clearly within his own White House, his own political appointees have very little faith in him. And consequently, with his tweets, he's indicated he has very little faith in them. And so when the only person that he feels is, or at least he's tweeting about, who he purports has a good relationship based on unwavering faith, is the dictatorial, murderous dictator in Pyongyang, we're in big trouble.
And this is a guy that killed his own half-brother with a binary form of a nerve agent, which is quite sophisticated, and it gets you back to the Novichok, which we learn more about now from the UK. They've identified the GRU officers. The GRU, of course, were behind the hacks of the DNC and of Podesta. And we don't know what went on in that secret meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. It's not inconceivable that some kind of deal was made to help Trump out in November. He doesn't want to be impeached. He doesn't want the Democrats to take the House. Is that a possibility that the Russians could bail him out for a second time, having helped elect him in 2016? Could they somehow make the Democratic blue wave disappear through cyber mischief?
Well, the Russians want nothing more than for President Trump to remain in office. He is the ideal leader of the United States from their perspective, not even so much because he espouses pro-Putin and pro-Russian policies and viewpoints, although that's part of it. But they enjoy the fact that he is destroying democratic institutions in this country. We talked about the tweet referring to the Justice Department investigation of Republican congressmen. I mean, for the GRU and other high-level officials in the Kremlin, this is exactly what they love to see, is a person occupying the Oval Office who is eroding confidence in America's democratic institutions. They want to see America weakened as a result, because that means that we're on our back foot and they have more room to conduct their corrupt dealings in their neighborhood, amongst their neighboring countries, and continue to act out aggressively in Ukraine, Syria, and elsewhere. So this is music to Putin's ears, what he's seeing happening, playing out daily in the United States. And, you know, sure, it's possible that he will support Republicans in the midterms as a part of a strategy to keep Trump in place. I think, you know, what I'm sure he's going to keep doing is sowing mischief and chaos, using tactics like supporting both sides of a controversial issue, which the Russians have done now for many years, and we know all about it. You know, they support, on the one hand, Black Lives Matter activists, and then they will also support online, using fake personas, you know, white nationalists, and try and get them to clash with each other, because they want to see our country divided. They want to see us not succeed. They want to see us fail. They see Trump as a central pillar in that strategy.
Well, just in closing, there's a lot more mischief that Vladimir Putin can mete out, particularly as he and Assad and the Iranians are about to conduct their offensive against the last holdout of the opposition, the rebels in Syria, in Idlib. That will create a humanitarian catastrophe and drive more refugees into Turkey. And we know from what happened when Putin first intervened in Syria, shortly thereafter, there was a massive exodus, and it seems likely that that was arranged by Assad and Putin to give these people safe passage or die. They flooded Europe. This created tremendous social problems in Europe itself. He has the ability, as the Sakir at the time said, to weaponize refugees. He has the ability to do it again. So
absolutely,
don't we need some kind of policy here? You know, we're always on our back foot. It's pathetic.
I completely agree. I think we do, and it's a very conscious strategy that Putin is employing. And don't forget also, Ian, that when Trump met with Putin on the margins of the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, in July of last year, his singular achievement that he touted coming out of that meeting, aside from a joint cyber unit between the U.S. and Russia, which he quickly walked back when he realized how foolish that was a de-escalation agreement in Syria. And the premise of that agreement was that there would be de-escalation zones created in Syria, and that folks would gather in these zones and they would be safe from attack. And these zones would be guarded by Russian military police. And by the way, Idlib was supposed to be one of those zones. And now, of course, Putin is using that in order to annihilate the anti-Assad opposition in Syria. And this was all part of a very conscious strategy. Trump got suckered right into it. And he's now playing out his last move, or penultimate move in this game, which is to completely crush the opposition in Syria, give Assad total control over at least the western half of the country, and drive refugees into Europe, which destabilizes Turkey and it destabilizes European countries, leading to this growth, this sort of metastasis of nationalist populism across the continent. Putin knows exactly what he's doing, and you know, unfortunately, our president, instead of seeing this as a conscious strategy to undermine Europe, himself is undermining the European Union and NATO with his pro-Russian statements, questioning whether the U.S. would come to the defense of our NATO allies, as he did with Montenegro, and outright, flat-out saying that the European Union is not bringing benefits to its members, when it's an institution that has, in fact, created the greatest peace and prosperity and security since World War II. So, it's just astounding what we see playing out these days.
Well, Dr. Michael Carpenter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control, who previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as director for Russia at the National Security Council. And prior to that, he was a career foreign service officer with the State Department. He's now a senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has an article at Foreign Affairs, co-authored with former Vice President Joe Biden, How to Stand Up to the Kremlin, Defending Democracy Against Its Enemies. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the political impact of the revelations in the op-ed by a White House insider on Trump's enablers in the House and Senate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
Well, thank you, David. And of course, the great questions of tomorrow are, will the few adults left in the room now in the White House get purged? And will Donald Trump bring in Jared and Ivanka to run the show?
That's a terrible question. I think it's the kind of thing we've been driven to because we live in crazy times. But I guess what I pick up out of your question is this idea of adults in the room. I'm not sure that if you stay in the room, you can be defined as an adult anymore. I don't know that by remaining there to keep Trump's hands off the tiller, you're doing more good than by stepping out of the shadows and announcing and describing the crisis in leadership we have because we have a president who's unfit to lead. I don't think that there is a lot of evidence, even in what we've read out of the Woodward book and so forth, that, you know, Mattis and the other so-called adults in the room are actually changing Trump's behavior that much. There's a report that Mattis, you know, shrugged off sort of an effort to launch an attack to kill Assad. But, you know, that's at the margins. And there's, by the way, no guarantee that there weren't, you know, 20 people down the line who would just as easily have shrugged that off. You know, in other words, that Mattis is playing some unique role. You're supposed to not follow through on illegal orders. You know, the New York Times op-ed by this anonymous person has raised the question of whether people who remain in the shadows and assume the powers of the presidency unto themselves because they see the current president is unfit are doing us a favor or doing themselves a favor by assuming that power are saving us from a constitutional crisis, or are in fact causing a constitutional crisis?
Well, I think from the point of view of the Mattises or those professional servants of the U.S. government who recognize the danger of this reckless and ignorant and incompetent presidency and this unbelievable behavior by the president, from their point of view, they probably think, well, you know, he was elected by the people of the United States. But at the same time, if they just sort of let him go ahead and become the kind of bull in the china shop that he is and do stuff that is incredibly dangerous and may, because he, after all, he has the nuclear codes, at what point are they responsible? Are you suggesting that they shouldn't restrain him? They shouldn't take papers off the desk that could start a war in North Korea?
No, I'm saying that I think their ability to restrain him is somewhat limited, and that they would restrain him better by stepping up, owning their criticism, and putting pressure on the people who are actually in a position to provide oversight. And that's, of course, the United States Congress. When the founders established the United States, they recognized that you might have a bad apple as president. And they said, well, let's put in place checks and balances that would come from Capitol Hill. But the reality is that this Congress has not done its job there. And so by coming forward, there are two things they can do. They can hold the feet to the fire of the Republicans who say there's nothing to worry about here. They can put pressure on the McConnells and the Ryans, who are, in fact, the enablers of Trump, and as guilty as Trump for all of the excesses and abuses of Trump. And if that doesn't work, by coming forward in the next 56 days, they can have an impact on an election which can take the control away from these Republicans and put it in the hands of the Democrats. And even if you're not a Democrat, you have to recognize that we're in a situation where the only way that we can truly control the president is using constitutional checks that come from the legislative branch.
Well, in this op-ed, of course, there was whispers of the 25th Amendment circulating amongst the cabinet, or at least in the higher echelons of the White House. And today, Elizabeth Warren said it's time to use the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office. But on the other hand, Senator Lindsey Graham said the New York Times op-ed by the anonymous author will matter zero. So I guess the question is, what will move the needle in terms of outrage? I mean, I'm astounded. For example, just the other day, Trump basically said that he's attacking Sessions because he indicted two crooked Republican congressmen, and he's basically saying you shouldn't indict Republicans. I mean, that you would think right in the midst of a confirmation hearing on Trump's choice for the Supreme Court. In the real world of reason and decency, that would disqualify Trump's choice because of who the person is that's making this judicial choice.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, look, I think that, you know, you've got a lot of people with a lot of different perspectives here on this. And, you know, Lindsey Graham is a kind of a pilot fish who's attached himself to the hulk of this whale and is flying, you know, decided he's going to go and defend Trump no matter what. And any credibility he might have had as a truth speaker a couple of years ago. And I remember sitting at a breakfast in Davos with Lindsey Graham in January of 2016, in which he said, I'll be playing in the NBA before, you know, anybody as unqualified as Donald Trump becomes president of the United States. Well, he's come a long way. You know, don't know what his psychological journey to get him there is, but he has no credibility on this at this point. And as you point out, Trump is on a daily basis testing norms, abusing them, and threatening the attorney general and saying that, you know, he should have taken into consideration that these were political allies that were being prosecuted and he shouldn't have prosecuted them, is undermining the rule of law. Just like in the wake of the anonymous op-ed, Trump saying the New York Times should turn over this person for national security reasons because the person should be arrested for expressing their opinion. Just like the day before, he said we shouldn't allow protests in the United States. And the point is, at what moment is this such a crisis that having this man as president of the United States is such a crisis that it warrants people coming out of their cubbyholes, declaring the problem, giving evidence, shining a light on it? you know, and you know, you can say everything you want about the anonymous article. There were scores of anonymouses who made the Woodward book possible, right? Scores of people who want to ingratiate themselves to history, you know, through whispers and saying, yeah, he's a really, really bad guy. Well, what are you doing about it? What are you doing about it when this guy is waging war on First Amendment rights, on due process rights, on national norms? When, you know, and today, in the midst of all of this, his administration seeks to detain children at the border indefinitely and made legal moves to do that today. This is a very dark moment in the United States, not just because of Donald Trump, but because we don't know how our system can protect us from Donald Trump.
So rather than hope that the Republicans discover some spine and decency and do the right thing, except, you know, the only ones that are either dead or retiring, on the positive side, I've noticed that whenever you've been on MSNBC, David, and speaking the truth about who this man is, you've often made people uncomfortable. And I notice now that they're sort of catching up with you and other people who've been saying for the longest time that this guy is dangerous, ignorant, reckless, and out of control, or I guess unhinged is the new description out there. So is that, you think, a positive thing, that there'll be no longer any pretense at normalizing him? People will be able to say, because the evidence is so manifest, that this guy is out of control.
If it leads to a positive outcome, you know, it didn't take a particular degree of perspicacity to say Donald Trump is a liar or he's corrupt or that he hangs out with bad people or he's got bad values. Donald Trump has been all those things for decades. It's not an accident that in the borough of Manhattan, where Donald Trump has made his home for all of his adult life, he got something like 10 or 12% of the electoral vote. The closer you are to Donald Trump, the more you know he's a bad guy. And there are just a lot of people who are out there who are like, I'm so pissed off at Washington, and I don't like what's going on there, and this guy will shake that up, but won't that be an entertaining show, who somehow think that politics is the Kardashians or some other kind of reality show, and that stirring it up is enough. You know, and what we found out is that you've now got somebody in there who's stirring it up by undermining the rule of law, undermining the Constitution of the United States, violating laws serially, cozying up to our enemies overseas, providing them aid and comfort. And we aren't getting closer to containing him because Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and the people on the Hill have allowed it to continue because they can use him to get a Kavanaugh in place. They can use him to get a tax bill in place. They can use him to serve their narrow group of constituents. And, I the most cynical interpretation of how things are going to unfold may also end up being the correct one. And that is, these people will continue to do this until they don't need him anymore, at which point they will abandon him. And I think the closer you get to 2020, if his numbers remain this way, the closer you get to a moment where you start getting a bunch of Republicans breaking with him. And if 30, 40, 50 seats switch in the House, and all of a sudden the myth of Trump's political genius evaporates, as it should, because it's a myth, you may see that happen a little bit sooner, and then there may be some checks on him. But until then, you know, public outrage from the groups of people who've long been outraged by Trump is not enough to change the situation.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that the reason that the Republicans are so craven and supine is that they're afraid they get, during the primaries they get primaried, and now they will not get reelected because the base is sticking with Trump, and the statistics or the polls indicate over 80% of Republicans support Trump. So if that's the reason why McConnell is behaving the way he is, then I think the person that you have to blame most of all is Rupert Murdoch, because he is keeping that base that the Republicans are so afraid of antagonizing. He's keeping them in that bubble of delusion, in that alternative universe where everything that Trump says is true and everything that the media says, or at least the New York Times and other media, short of Fox, is fake news. So to my mind, the man who speaks often to Trump on the phone, who's apparently something of a mentor, gets off the phone and says, what an idiot. At the same time, his propaganda operation basically has created this alternative universe with alternative facts.
I think you're right. And I think Rupert Murdoch is a story we ought to delve into a little bit more, because there was a moment at the end of the Reagan administration when the president of the United States scurried around a bit in order to enable Rupert Murdoch to become very quickly an American citizen, to buy Fox at precisely the same time we were eliminating the fairness doctrine from American television, that changed the nature of politics in the United States to be what is happening now. And if you want to trace the record back to where you get to Trump, you got to go back to Murdoch and Reagan and the late 80s and these decisions. Now, having said that, Murdoch sees Trump as a vehicle to advance his special interests. Paul Ryan saw Trump as a vehicle to advance his interests on tax reform. Mitch McConnell saw Trump as a vehicle to advance his interests on packing the courts with conservatives. Donors to Trump have seen Trump as a vehicle to eliminate regulations that cost money to their businesses, to enhance their bottom line, or to otherwise advance their agenda. And so what's going on here is, as cynical as it gets, it is as corrupt as it gets. It's people who are not fulfilling their oaths to the Constitution of the United States or to the people of the United States, setting aside patriotic values, setting aside standards and norms in the United States for the past 230, 40 years, and saying, I got an agenda. And if it takes having a lunatic in the White House to advance my agenda, if it takes having a crook, if it takes having somebody who was put there by one of our enemies, if it takes having that person paddle up to that enemy and commit, you know, potentially what is effectively treason as it meets the constitutional definition of adhering to an enemy and providing them aid and comfort, if it takes all those things and I get what I want, so be it. It is the most cynical moment in the history of the United States. And as a result, it is the most dangerous moment for democracy.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a visiting professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's been a longtime contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and was CEO and editor of the Foreign Policy Group. And his latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to the UK to look into what steps the unpopular British government can take to retaliate against Russia's use of nerve agents to deter future attacks.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nico Hines, the London editor of The Daily Beast, who previously was a reporter for The Times of London and also their Washington correspondent. And his latest article at The Daily Beast is How Russian Spies Used a Fake Nina Ricci Perfume Bottle to Smuggle Novichok Nerve Agent into England. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nico Hines. Well, thank you, Nico. And it's, I guess, the ubiquitous closed-circuit television network that they have in the UK, which many people think is somewhat Orwellian, has paid off in the case of figuring out who was behind the Novichok poisoning. They've identified two GRU Russian military intelligence officers. So what is the sense in the UK now about something that is clearly an attack on, actually it's a use of a weapon of mass destruction against a peaceful country?
Yeah, you know, we've already had attacks like this with, you may remember Litvinenko, who was, Alexander Litvinenko, who was a dissident, a Russian dissident who was murdered in London in 2006 with this radioactive poison, polonium-210. And it took a long time, but eventually Britain accused Russia publicly and said that Putin was probably responsible for ordering this murder. And at the time, it was such an extraordinary, incredible, kind of something out of a movie, dramatic way to kill someone. I think everyone thought that was going to be a one-off. And the fact that they have then repeated this action and had somebody else, or this time they didn't succeed in killing him, of course, Sergei Skripal, he survived the attack. But the fact that they've used another James Bond-esque method to try and kill somebody on British soil, it just leaves people thinking, what can we do to stop this now? Obviously, we can't go to war with Russia, but how are we going to stop this happening again? Who knows? Maybe tomorrow Putin's going to order someone else to be murdered. Maybe this time it will be someone in the US.
Well, it's hard to believe that anybody defends Putin and thinks, I mean, these stupid stories about somehow it came from, because Salisbury's near where the UK has its, I don't know how active their biological and chemical weapon program is, they're largely being banned under an international agreement. But the fact that Porton Down is nearby has led some apologists on the political left to think that somehow there was some nefarious behavior on the part of British intelligence, but it absolutely seems so obvious that Putin's a former KGB colonel. He's said publicly many times that the worst human beings on the planet are traitors. He hates traitors. Skripal was a traitor. He was a GRU officer who spilled the beans and gave the West a lot of valuable intelligence, which ended up rolling up this network of sleepers here in the United States with the redhead Chapman woman that Putin fated when she returned to Russia. And it looks as if these orders were just sort of out there, and the GRU was getting revenge against one of their traitors, and they did it on their clock as opposed to, you know, I don't think it was timed. I think it was just like they sent them out, gave them orders, and they struck when it was convenient. And that's,
yeah, I mean, it is interesting, of course, that he was a kind of former colleague of theirs. And I don't know, you know, we won't find out, I suppose, you know, whether people he betrayed are now high up within the GRU. Perhaps it was a kind of personally motivated attack in that way. But I think one thing you can be absolutely sure of is that nobody in Russia does anything that is going to have geopolitical consequences unless they're very safe in the knowledge that Vladimir Putin approves this mission. There's no way that the GRU were freelancing here. So, you know, the British minister said today that Putin had ultimate responsibility for this attack, and I think that's something that we'll never be able to prove. There won't be a piece of paper signed by Vladimir Putin saying, yeah, go ahead and do this. But I think it is almost certain that he would have directed it himself, in some way, at least. And as you say, there have been some, you know, conspiracy theories and ideas that perhaps this is in some way not what it appears to be. But I think the job that Scotland Yard have done in collating all these photographs of them arriving at the airport, getting the train, getting the tube, staying in the hotel, which had traces of this drug, and then following them, going to this guy's house, you know, it really... any jury would convict. I think we can put it that way.
Well, of course, the National Security Advisor, Putin's National Security Advisor, Nikolai Petrushev, if you think our guy, John Bolton, is a uber hawk, Petrushev is completely nuts. So I don't think he would have objected to it if not issue the orders with the blessing of Putin himself. But do you think that they struck at the UK because it's sort of a low-hanging fruit? In other words, do you think they'd be brazen enough to do something here in the United States?
Well, this is the question. I suspect that they probably would be, yes. I mean, if you kind of, if one games it out, and imagine that this had happened in I don't know, some kind of quiet part of Maine, perhaps, which would be the equivalent of Salisbury. And similarly, there would initially be some kind of confused reports. I'm sure that, you know, Breitbart would probably be picking up some conspiracy theory that perhaps it was an escaped, you know, poison from a U.S. military facility. You know, you can imagine the same sorts of false theories, and then eventually it would, you know, the FBI would kind of present their case to the public. What would happen? What would the U.S. do that it's not doing now? They, you know, Trump, apparently now, we now learn from that anonymous New York Times editorial, reluctantly Trump agreed to expel those Russian diplomats over this Salisbury incident in Britain. But we hear that he didn't want to do that. But I guess they would expel some more diplomats. But, you know, the question mark is, really, the question being raised by all of these aggressions from Putin is anybody willing to stand up and do something that will force him not to do such a thing again? We know that he's, you know, invaded Crimea, the first kind of claim of land in another country since the Second World War in Europe, and nobody's done anything about it. What next? What will we allow him to get away with?
Well, it seems that our president would let him get away with just about anything, because he actually was dragged kicking and screaming into going along with that. And the op-ed that you referred to from the anonymous senior staffer in the administration makes it clear that Trump has an affection for dictators. In fact, today, of course, he tweeted out thanks to Kim Jong-un for praising his unwavering leadership.
Yeah, that's right. One interesting twist on this is that although Britain in some ways, like you suggested, might be a softer target than the US, it's actually strategically quite an important country for Putin and his allies, you know, the oligarchs who have power and all the money in Moscow. A lot of them have large proportions of their wealth invested in London. They come to London, their kids go to the expensive public schools in Britain. They buy these huge mansions in the kind of richest parts of London. And in a way, Britain is actually uniquely placed to actually bring some financial distress to Putin's allies. And we know that's the one thing that does seem to kind of upset him and his friends, is when they're not allowed to make use of their ill-gotten gains. So, you know, Britain has been making noises about finding ways to clamp down on these Russians who are here and to somehow strip their assets, or at least to force them to leave the country. So Putin might actually have this time stepped too far in that sense, and then there might be some punishment. Of course, it's nothing on the global scale, but at least Britain is actually in a position to do something.
So, Nico Hines, how is this translating, though, politically in the UK with such a tenuous hold on power that the Conservatives have? The Brexit thing is like an albatross. They don't know how to get out from under it. I don't know whether or not there's going to be a do-over and another vote, which would probably get them out of this paralysis. But where does Corbyn stand on Russia? I mean, Corbyn was completely gutless when it came to Brexit itself. If he had made a stand, it maybe could have made a difference, but he didn't. So what's happening politically there with the response to what the Russians have done?
Well, in a way, it's probably something that Theresa May is pleased to be talking about, because, as you say, everything domestically and in terms of Brexit is such a disaster. Every single word she says is criticised by people on both sides of the debate, and that's just within her own party, let alone when you start bringing everybody else in. So, you know, there was actually an extraordinary moment when she was discussing these details. Scotland Yard went first and announced that they that charges were being brought against these two Russian men, and they showed some of the evidence. But they didn't say anything about who these men were. And Theresa May then saved this moment of theatre. She actually announced in the House of Commons that they were believed to be GRU operatives. And there was an intake of breath in the House of Commons, and people were genuinely shocked that she'd gone that far. Of course, that was the sort of suspicion. But to say that we had the actual proof, or, you know, believed that we knew that, was a kind of dramatic moment. And so at least it's given Theresa May the opportunity to be a leader, to talk about something that isn't internal wranglings. And obviously it's a very difficult position to be in, but I think the nation is united over this issue, apart from one or two people, as you mentioned, on the left. Now, Jeremy Corbyn, who has spent his entire life as a protester, basically, a demonstration leader, a rabble-rousing speech giver at marches, and always he's been on the side of stop the war, was the kind of big group that he was high up in, which was formed around the Iraq war. And that group has always basically attacked American, British, so-called imperialist kind of machinations, which have included the Iraq war and subsequent peacekeeping missions or invasions in Libya and that sort of thing. He's always been against those things. And his history of the protest movement goes back even further than that, you know, to things like the Vietnam War and what was going on in South America under Reagan. So you have to understand Corbyn's perspective in that context, in that he's been campaigning against what America and, as a result, Britain have been doing foreign policy-wise for his entire life. And, of course, for a lot of that period, that meant siding with the Soviet Union, not maybe in everything that they did, but his natural inclination would have been to look at the to be in favor of the people who were standing up to America. And so I think a lot of people, including Corbyn, are naturally suspicious when a British or American leader stands up and says, we can't prove to you why, but we know this was the Russians. There's a lot of people who instinctively want to cast doubt about those sorts of claims, because they would say, and they would have a point, you know, Reagan stood up and lied about what had happened in Nicaragua. Nixon lied about what was happening in Vietnam. Tony Blair and George Bush lied about what was happening in Iraq. Why should we believe them now? And, you know, there is some rationality to that point. But having seen all of the evidence now, I think it really is only cranks and kind of extreme weirdos who don't believe that Russia was front and center in this operation.
Well, Nico Hines, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Nico Hines, who is the London editor of The Daily Beast. He was previously a reporter for The Times of London and also the Washington correspondent. And his latest article at The Daily Beast is How Russian Spies Used Fake Nino Ricci Perfume Bottles to Smuggle Novichok Nerve Agent into England. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lerivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.